Good afternoon and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, June 13th, 2000. In the Creekside Room this afternoon, Paul Olson continues his series on great stories you need to know. Today's session is entitled Drama Off-Broadway, Great Scenes, and is sharing scenes from some of the best African-American dramas. This is session OLP 2000-2. Let's listen in.
Why do you, I got this one up here, and you got that one. And yes, last night it didn't come through very well, I guess. What we've got our seats for so that you can hit these, you're okay, hit these microphones or that one.
But you're going to be writing up there?
Nah, not so much, you're fine. And are you taking notes anyway? Like, who cares? what's art for? I mean, let's get to the real bottom of this stuff, love. I mean, I teach literature, and why do we bother with it? And what I thought I would do is, one, ask you that question, two, give you a couple responses from, one, a novelist and a dramatist, and that's James Baldwin, and another, Lorraine Hansberry, the dramatist, and just see what she says about why we do this stuff. And then we'll get right into the specifics of, you know, how they make manifest why they believe what they do. Wow. Okay. So, why art? Why drama? We'll be specific. What happens to us in drama?
I think we can see things of ourselves up on the stage. I mean, like, ancient Greek tradition is like this cathartic experience, you know, to watch your fellow citizens acting out an experience or a scenario that you could be a part of.
What's a cathartic experience again?
I mean, like, letting out a lot of emotions, kind of
That's good.
Cleansing.
Yeah, the cleansing, sure. We let it out. We cry at those dramas. You guys cry at watching TV shows? I can't believe myself. I have tears in my eyes. I mean, it could be the crappiest show there is. And I'm sitting here, I get tears in my eyes. Then I learned there's a whole, you know, you probably, maybe some of you know, there's a whole different chemical makeup of tears that come from sad, from emotion involved, like in watching drama, as opposed to tears of sadness. Tears of joy have different chemical makeup. It's pretty cool stuff. We are really a walking miracle, aren't we? Okay, we see ourselves. There's this kind of, we let it all out. I like that phrase.
It's a safe way to express a lot of emotions that otherwise would be, I think, threatening.
Why is that safer?
It's not attacking you personally. If you're watching something, you can get a sense of maybe why someone is angry or upset or sad or finds something funny that you don't, you know. But you are sort of, you're anonymous in a in an audience.
Yeah.
Or if you're up on stage, then it's not really you, it's the character. So you get the chance to express it.
Yeah. That makes me think of, you ever listen to, ever heard an interview by Henry Fonda? Who talks a lot about how shy he is, or was. And I've done a lot of drama with a one-man play for years and years and years all over the country. And I can't believe how nervous I get. I can't believe how what lack of confidence I have before the bell goes off or, you know, the show starts. And then as soon as it starts, it's gone because I'm not me. And so I can do things that I could never do myself. I can say things and I understand that. And there's a safety line behind that, in your line behind the character. And there's that for the actor and for the audience. That's a great observation. Other things that happens to
you. You said art. Did you just mean drama?
I mean any kind of art. Drama is what we're looking at today, but run with it.
It just seems like it's a direct pipeline to the emotions.
Ooh, nice phrase. Pipeline to the emotions. Pipeline to anything else. I mean, for sure that's true. And as a teacher of literature, one of the things I hope for most of all with my students is that you will get, your guts and your heart are going to be struck. My favorite phrase in teaching is literary criticism starts in the guts. Most of us start literary criticism in the brain, and I think it's a mistake. Because your phrase is right. This is a pipeline to the emotions. And we are, for sure, we are emotional beings. But we're more than emotional beings. We don't just sit there. I mean, I can cry or get sad at ER. But when it's over, it's over. I don't walk away, you know, kind of with all kinds of thoughts about, wow, that's pretty heavy philosophical stuff. But I do when I see Lear, Shakespeare's Lear. But I've also cried. Ho, ho. Lear starts out, you know, when he's carrying his dead daughter off to the people. That's emotional, but there's more. Okay, well, it's a pipeline to the emotions. It's a pipeline to others, dimensions of ourselves.
A pipeline between people.
Nice phrase. Between people.
There's always some universal aspect.
I'm going to add this to that, and use your word again, universal. But where are we going to read stuff by black? None of us is black, and we're going to read drama today by black writers. Is there a pipeline between us? Obviously, if I'm white, and if I didn't think there was a pipeline, I couldn't teach this stuff. Good. So there's a pipeline of emotions, a pipeline between people. What else? You're on the good stuff, I think.
I feel I experience something I've never experienced before. Like Chorus Line or Phantom of the Opera. I didn't know what it was like to be those people, but it's like I did when I was in the play. Understand and know more about them.
Yeah. Great point. Art, two ways. Art is about experience. We have never invested $10,000 and lost it all because of Stump, Soup, and Move. That's one of the scenes that we're going to look at in Raisin in the Sun. So it'll be about that experience. But we're going to experience, Willie, is it gone? I mean, we've lost everything, and we feel that too. So it's about, and it is. And it's a great assessment. More things. It's a pipeline too. I guess I'm going to stop there because I don't know who cares. Well, we care about what we think, but we want to get to these guys too, just because we've only got an hour. What are the dimensions of the self that are struck by good art? And I just think a minute about what are you made up of? What kinds of, you know, if you had to categorize, this is my emotional self, this is my blank self. More pipelines to the emotions, to the, what else makes you who you are?
Just the psyche, and then like your whole, the way your mind works.
I'll use two words. We are spiritual beings, for sure. And there's something deeper than just ER. It might get our emotions, but does it get our spirit? I don't know. It's going to take a pretty complex show to do that. Good. Our psyche, our spirit.
I think sometimes you can tell greater truths through fiction. You don't let the details of what actually happened. You can refine the message in order to get to a greater truth.
I've written this backwards, so it's a pipeline to truth. I love the line from The Man of La Mancha where Don Quixote says, in answer to his comrades, he says, I want the facts, I want the facts. He says, no, no, the facts are the greatest enemy of truth. That's my favorite phrase for understanding the book of Genesis, especially the first two chapters. The facts get in the way of the truth. Are birds created before bees? Well, never mind. Okay, more. It's a pipeline of the truth to our emotions, still ourselves. Right here, this is a clue. Mm-hmm. To our intellect, for sure, that's part of what we are. And if something doesn't strike our intellect, it's not going to be as full dimensional, it's not going to be as good. A play, in the case we're working on today. The art isn't as good. Our intellect, our spirit, our psyche, our emotions.
I think especially like dance can be a really real pipeline to your physical self.
I think so. And the way that literary artists do that, I think, is their control of language. There's something about the great sentence. Somebody came up to me after last night's session and just read a sentence out of Toni Morrison's a different book that we were talking about, the Song of Solomon, and the sentence just sent you. It somehow struck with the physical rhythms of that language, and we all speak it every day. That's why Hi Diddle, the cat and the fiddle, the cow jumped over the moon. When we were little, it worked for us, and it was the physical that doesn't work anymore because it doesn't do anything intellectually or emotionally for us. But it did something physical at one time, and well, now grand language, and every once in a while, we're going to hear it today too. For sure, things like Paradise Lost. For sure, all of Shakespeare. For sure, all of William Styron's Sophie's Choice. For sure, most of Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon has language that works on us, you know, viscerally, that helps be that pipeline to all this. Great. If there's more, fire away with it. We'll go to some, I've got some excerpts here that we can share and have fun with. I wanted to read before we started that a philosophical statement by Lorraine Hansberry that addressed two ideas that, well, they address all of these collectively, but especially this one right here. Can black and white, can drama be a pipeline to all people at all time? And Hansberry, after The Raisin in the Sun, it becomes a very famous play, and she is interviewed. And this is for anybody, but especially you English majors, to be young, gifted, and black is a wonderful book about her and all her drama and how it works in with her. It's juxtaposed with letters that she's written and speeches that she's given, and back and forth we go from drama to herself, and it assesses the purpose of the drama a lot. Well, one part of that is this. An interview says, I'm sure it's asked you many times, you may be tired of it. This is not really a Negro play. Why should this be about, why this could be about anybody? It's a play about people. What is your action? What do you say? Here's Lorraine Hansberry. I think she's like 31 when she says this. She dies when she's about 34 of cancer, way too young. This could be about anybody. It's a play about people. What do you say? Well, I hadn't noticed the contradiction, because I'd always been under the impression that Negroes are people. But actually, it's an excellent question, because invariably, that has been the point of reference. And I do know what people are trying to say. People are trying, what they're trying to say, is that this is not what they consider a traditional treatment of the Negro in the theater. They're trying to say that it isn't a propaganda play, that it isn't something that hits you over the head. They're trying to say that they believe the characters in our play transcend category. However, it is an unfortunate way to try and say it, because I believe that one of the most sound ideas in dramatic writing is that in order to create the universal, you must pay very great attention to the specific. All artists do that. When one of my favorite illustrations is, because he's got so much criticism for it, is Styron's Sophie's Choice, is that that's about the Holocaust. But he never mentions the number 6 million, he never mentions the number 12 million, he never talks about 3 million in Auschwitz. He talks about one woman for 629 pages. And the depth and complexity of her scars, theological, psychological, emotional, physical, all of them wrapped up in this one character, because he has paid very, very great attention to the specific. Universality, I think, emerges from truthful identity of what is. In other words, I have told people that not only is this a Negro family, specifically that's the one we're going to look at, A Raisin in the Sun. Here's this family in Southside Chicago. Specifically and definitely culturally, but it's not even a New York family or a Southern Negro family. It is specifically Southside Chicago. That kind of care, that kind of attention to detail. In other words, I think people, to the extent we accept them and believe them as who they're supposed to be, to that extent they can become everybody. So I would say it is definitely a Negro play before it is anything else. So, yeah, this is a play about black, but it's a pipeline, and she said it now in different words, but your words are, this play can be a pipeline to all of the things that you suggested via this one family. That anybody here live on the South Side of Chicago? Anybody who lived the black experience? Maybe one, but not the other. Well, I'm going to kick this off with a very unknown play by Lorraine Hansberry, called The Drinking Gourd. And the story is, or the drama of the story is, a young boy named Hannibal meets his girlfriend or his lover, or just we know that there's a close relationship, in the woods, and he's about to run away. Her name is Sarah. His name is Hannibal. It's a very short play. The drama speaks for itself. This is Lorraine Hansberry. The setting is the woods. Hannibal! Hannibal! And when she come to me, it were the moonrise. And when she touched my hand, it were the true stars fallen. Hannibal! What you always running off for all the time? You're going to catch you another whipping, boy. Don't run off all the time. Oh, Hannibal! Oh, Hannibal! Oh, Hannibal! But you got there, Hannibal. Hannibal, Marster find you stole that Bible, you'd be in trouble bad. Me and you was born in trouble with the Marster. What you think the Lord think of somebody who would steal the holy book itself? Sarah, what you think I would do with the Bible? Sarah, I can read it. I can read, Sarah. Listen. The book of Jeremiah. Hannibal. You can't make them marks out for real. You done memorized from a prayer meeting or something. No, Sarah. And I said, oh, that I had wings like a dove. Then would I fly away and be at rest. He closes the book and looks at her, and she stares at him in joy and wonder. So that's where you go all the time. Somebody been learning you. Don't you know what they do if they finds out? Ain't nobody gonna find out. Don't you worry, little Sarah. Hey, look at here.
What?
Look at that big old fat star shining away up yonder there.
Shh, Hannibal.
1, 2, 3, 4. They makes up the dipper. That's the big dipper, Sarah. The old drinking gourd herself, pointing straight to the North Star. Sure is bright tonight. Sure would make good traveling light tonight.
Stop it.
Trees on this plantation got more ears than leaves. Up there, just pointing the way, due north.
Shh.
You're sure like your brother, boy. Just like him. For the old man is a-waiting for to carry you to freedom if you follow the drinking gourd. Follow, follow. If you follow the drinking gourd.
You look like him, you talk like him, and God knows you sure think like him.
In time, I reckon, you'd be gone like him. Sarah, you think Isaiah got all the way to Canada?
Yeah, sure he did. I bet you old Isaiah's up there and got himself a job and is living fine. I bet you that. I bet he works in a lumber yard or something and got himself a wife and maybe even a house and...
You mean if he's alive, Hannibal?
Oh, he's alive, all right. He's alive and he's free.
I met him here that night to bring the food and an extra pair of shoes. And he was standing right over there, with the moonlight streaming down on him, and he was breathing hard. Lord, that boy was breathing so as you could almost hear him on the other side of the woods. He didn't say nothing to me. Nothing at all. I just handed him the parcel, and he put it in his shirt and gave me a kind of push on the shoulder. Here. And then he turned and lit out through them woods like lightning. He was bound out of this place.
You hate to go, don't you, Hannibal?
Hannibal, how you know it's so much better to run off? And even if you make it, how you know what's up there? What it'd be like to go wandering around by yourself in this world?
I don't know. I just know what it is to be a slave.
We all slaves, Hannibal. But there's some ain't got it so bad. Who knows how to bend a little.
Then let them bend. Me, I'm the only kind of slave I could stand to be. A bad one. Every day that come and hour that pass that I got sense to make a half step do for a whole. Every day that I can pretend sickness instead of health. To be stupid instead of smart. Lazy instead of quick. I aims to do it. And the more pain it give Master and the more it cost him, the more Hannibal be a man.
Where would you go?
Just north. That's all I know. Try to find Isaiah, maybe.
How I know what I do? There's people up there that helps runaways.
You mean them abolitionists? I heard Master Sweet say that once they catch us runaways, they make soap out of them.
Oh, Sarah, that slave owner talk. Whatever you hear Master say about slavery, you always believe the opposite.
The way I look at it, every slave ought to run off before he die.
I couldn't go. I'm too delicate. My breath wouldn't hold out from here to the river.
No, not you, scarified as you is. But don't you worry, little Sarah. I'll come back. I'll come back and buy you. Mama, too, if she's still living. I surely do that thing. What happened? Plot to us in the audience. I don't know if you can tell, but I can't get through that scene. I have to stop and catch my self. What happens to us? What do we know now? Or feel? Or what if drama and art is experience, it's about experience, but it's also experience.
It just pulls you in.
And it's a great artist to do that, for sure. Her imagination, her language control, good, pulls us in. Can you articulate feelings or thoughts that you had? I'll come back.
She said very little about the forest, but I really felt I was in the forest.
Yeah, wow.
In that secret place, the hiding place. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
And the light of the star, you know, trying to show me the way.
And I didn't read one word of the setting. And you got that. Yeah. Wow, that's good. How about the people? Their experience. What do you know about slavery that you didn't know before? Or that you maybe knew before, but never...
Not new, but a lot of pride. And you could feel it coming through.
Pride.
Talking about, you know, all the little covert ways to stop work.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And how she didn't, apparently she didn't work enough to have a lot of strength. She was a delicate person.
Yeah.
How sad.
Yeah, yeah.
She could have practiced that.
Get in shape, go out and run her 5 miles a day.
Or maybe she's just been told so often. Oh, you could never make it anywhere.
Yeah.
Okay, you start to believe that.
Sure, period, sure.
So, especially being black and a slave.
And a woman. Mm-hmm. Yep. And that, yep. Good.
I think that, like, a universal part that I sort of related to was kind of when she said, or the line stuck in my mind was when she was talking about some of us just bend a little bit and make that. And in so many situations, you know, there's some people we'll bend, or sometimes that we bend, sometimes that we don't. And when do we draw the line, and who draws the difference?
And Hannibal, and let him bend. Mm-hmm. One of the things that black artists do carefully and with great deliberateness, and yet subtly, is undo the myths that have perpetuated themselves through, and then perpetuated deliberately through American culture. the stupid slave, well, I'm acting stupid. The contented Sambo, all these images that are passed on by, that get started at the very beginning of slavery, but then are finally instituted. It's not just attitudinal, that's a good phrase for it, racism, it's institutional. Racism. It's institutionalized by slavery itself. It's institutionalized by the church. It's institutionalized by, you know, in modern days, by the educational system. Then let them bend. But I'm going to make, you know, half a step instead of a whole, act stupid when I know it. All the things that he's refusing to do. Anything else you notice? If I don't know if I'm right, at least I'm right for me, that is that literary criticism starts in the guts. Where did you, at the point of the play, your stomach to do a flip-flop? Just, ooh.
He started talking about going north, and then he escaped, because then I started thinking about, like, is this realistic, or is he getting to make it up there, what happened to his brother?
Yeah.
We're being turned into soap.
Well, there are laws on the books, and we can rattle off about 15 of them, national laws, that make it legal to go get that slave. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and everything from Dred Scott to the Compromise of 1850 to 1854, all kinds of things that are there. And legally, we can go get you, and if we bring you back dead, you know, okay, no harm done. Mm-hmm.
When she guessed correctly that he was going to run, or that it was on his mind, I think that said a lot to me about how frightened she was for him, but also about the relationship the two of them had. Something about knowing each other well enough to know thoughts and feelings about them.
Yeah. That's a great observation, I think, that these people, they love each other. And he's going to give that up. I'll come back. And I'll buy you. And the line, I can hardly say it now, but I got it from. And I'll buy Mama too if she's still alive. But I'm going to leave all this. An interesting book that you might enjoy reading is Frederick Douglass' Slave Narrative. That he debates a lot. Do I run away? I mean, he debates on one hand. On one hand, he's certain that he's going to. I can't put up with this any longer. But Hamlet said it better to, you know, the devil that you know is better than, he doesn't put it that way, but the devil you know is better than the devil you don't know. What's up there? And the North, the owners did a good job of making that fear, making you into soap in the North. But Hannibal has kind of, even imaginatively, right? Nothing's going to happen to me. People that help abolitionists. Isaiah's got a job, he's got a wife, he's probably got a house, you know. Does he believe any of that? Huh?
I don't think so.
I don't either, but I know I can't live this way anymore. If it takes rationalizations or anything to get me out of here. Well, no, your turn. What I have now is several or four scenes from Raisin in the Sun. And I'll tell you the story that sets up these scenes. And we'll just see what we feel as we go through them, and you get to read them. So, the first one is, I just need two people. Both women, though I've never believed that women have to play women's parts and men and men. So who wants to be Vanitha and who wants to be, we got hands are up. Okay. There you are. And one's Mama, one's Vanitha. And the story, the basic story in Raisin in the Sun is this family in Southside Chicago is made up of Mama, and her husband is dead, and because he has died, she's got a $10,000 insurance policy coming. This is big money in 1951. And that $10,000 is going to free them up for lots of things. Well, they have three kids, Vanitha and Walter. They have two kids, Vanitha and Walter. And Vanitha, Walter. And Walter is married to Ruth, and they have a child, Travis. Vanitha is quintessential teenager out to experience life in lots of different ways, and is a little bit of a rebel, and that's what this scene is about. Vanitha cannot stomach Mama's giving God the credit. Vanitha, she's a very bright, intellectual kid who is rebellious, and you'll see that. Well, that's enough for that, and I'll come back to her in a second. Then this $10,000 is coming, and Walter wants to use it to buy a liquor store. And invest all of it in that so that they can get really rich and he can buy his wife, as he says at one point in the play. What man doesn't want to buy his wife some pearls? And I mean, he's poor and he's never bought her anything. But Mama, of course, with her religious background and her sense of equality with these people, can't give all the money to him to invest, you know, foolishly, let alone in a liquor store. So she decides that she will keep three, she will get three, 3.3, you know, right? And that he will get a third of it too, that Walter will. But with conflict about he's not the man of the house and he feels that, she gives it all to him and says, you go put this in the bank. And he doesn't. He does invest it with a friend of his, and we'll look at that scene too. And the friend runs off with the money. And then there's nothing for anybody. But at this point, what we're going to read right now is the conflict between Mama and Vanitha as they talk about... you'll see. It's the conflict of, is God running this household? And then the bigger question, the theme of the play is, is humankind responsible for its actions, or does God play a role in this? So go ahead, gang. Right there where the line is drawn.
Of course you're going to be a doctor, honey, God willing.
God hasn't got a thing to do with it.
Vanitha, that just wasn't necessary.
Well, neither is God. I get sick of hearing about God.
Vanitha!
I mean it. I'm just tired of hearing about God all the time. What has he got to do with anything?
Does
he pay tuition?
You about to get your fresh little jaw slapped.
That's just what she needs, all right. That's Ruth, the wife of...
Why? Why can't I say what I want to around here, like everybody else?
It don't sound nice for a young girl to say things like that. It wasn't brought up that way. Me and your father went to trouble to get you and brother to church every Sunday.
Molly, you don't understand. It's all a matter of ideas, and God is just one idea I don't accept. It's not important. I'm not going out and be immoral or commit crimes because I don't believe in God. I don't even think about it. It's just that I get tired of him getting credit for all the things that human race achieves, through its own stubborn effort. There simply is no blasted God. There is only man, and it is he who makes miracles.
Mama absorbs this speech, studies her daughter, and rises slowly and crosses to Benita and slaps her powerfully across the face.
Now, you say after me, in my mother's house, there is still God. In my mother's house, there is still God.
In my mother's house, there is still God.
There are some ideas we ain't gonna have in this house. Not long as I'm head of this thing.
Yes, ma'am.
End of scene. Yeah, well done, you guys.
So, what do you feel? Think?
Just quickly, we'll move on.
But anger.
I think that's really typical for a girl. I assume she's mentioned tuition, so she must be in college or something.
Yep.
To sort of be, I know that's how I was when I, my first couple years of college, like every old idea that my mother had ever instilled in me was gone.
I think for also a black woman to be in college in 1951 and to hand that off to God is a little bit, that's like, I worked for this.
Yeah.
I want the credit for it.
Yeah.
And you're not going to take it away from me by saying it was somebody else's power.
Now, the play isn't about themes, but themes come up. And one of them is that's important here is responsibility. And it's important, I think, to a black writer, especially, but I believe it's true in all art, in all literature, that responsibility, that humankind is responsible for its society, it's responsible for its actions. And to wait for some deus ex machina, you know, God come out of the sky and fix things, it ain't going to happen. So it's in all different levels that we say they are responsible for this world. Well, we're responsible. What happens now is Mama takes her $3,000, again, before it's, she hasn't actually taken the money, but she's gone out and bought a house in a white neighborhood. And in this next scene, her kids have already said, "Where did you buy a house?" "In Claiborne Park, there's no black people out there." "Well, there are now," she says proudly. And the next scene is, and how many people do we need? We need a Ruth. And it could be a saint, but whatever. Who's Ruth? Okay. We need a Lindner. He's a white guy from Claiborne Park who comes very nicely and wants to buy their house back. He doesn't go down there and say, "We don't want you niggers here." He comes and says, "You know, we can buy your house and give you a good deal on it." And you'll see that it's wonderful, subtle drama and the kind of bigoted thinking that's, well, you'll see. So we need, and Walter is here now. That's the, okay. Benita, that sister, is here again. And Linder.
I'm sorry, I have to go to dish duty.
Oh my goodness.
I'm too.
Okay. It doesn't have to be a man. Okay. Who's Linder? Okay, you're Linder. And Benita, again. The sister is there. And who's Benita? Okay. Let's see now. Okay, I've titled this in my section. This is Linder's first visit. He has two, and they're significant in that. See, we can do this. And, oh, yeah. Okay, let's just go. Start right there.
Do you want to read the intro? Or?
The door has rung, and the man, that is also Lindner, your man at first, then Lindner. The doorbell's rung, Benita has answered it, and he starts.
How do you do, miss? I'm looking for a Mrs. Lena Younger.
Oh, yes, that's my mother. Excuse me. Ruth, brother, somebody's here. Come in, please.
Just to set up for you, notice the ahs, and they're uneasy. They don't have many white guys to knock on their door, so... She's the guy. She is the white man.
The white guy.
Thank you for... We should explain that. He's the white man coming from Claiborne Park, and you'll hear what he wants to do.
Thank you.
My mother isn't here just now. Is it business?
Yes. Well, of a sort.
Have a seat. I'm Mrs. Younger's son. I look after most of her business matters.
Well, my name is Carl Linder.
Walter Younger. This is my wife and my sister.
How do you do?
What can we do for you, Mr. Linder?
Well, I'm a representative of the Claiborne Park Improvement Association.
Why don't you sit your things on the floor?
Oh, yes. Thank you. And as I was saying, I'm from the Claiborne Park Improvement Association, and we have it brought to our attention at the last meeting that you people, or at least your mother, has bought a piece of residential property at 406 Claiborne Street.
That's right. Care for something to drink? Rue, get Mr. Linder a beer.
Oh, no, really. I mean, thank you very much, but no thank you.
Some coffee?
Thank you. Nothing at all.
This is stopping for a second. What feelings do you get already?
Oh, yes.
I'm not going to be drinking with you folks. Yeah.
Well, I don't know how much you folks know about our organization. It's one of these community organizations set up to look after, things like block upkeep and special projects. And we also have what we call our New Neighbors Orientation Committee.
Yes, and what do they do?
Well, it's what you might call a sort of a welcoming committee, I guess. I mean, I'm the chairman of the committee, go around and see the new people who move into the neighborhood and sort of give them the lowdown on the way we do things out in Claiborne Park.
Uh-huh.
And we also have the category of what the association calls special community problems.
Yes, and what are some of those?
Girl, let the man talk.
Thank you. I would sort of like to explain this thing in my own way. I mean, I want to explain to you in a certain way.
Go ahead.
Yes. Well, I'm going to try to get right to the point. I'm sure that we'll all appreciate that in the long run.
Yes?
Be still now.
Well...
Would you like to have a chair? You don't look comfortable.
No, thank you very much. Please. Well, I'll get right to the point. I'm sure you people must be aware of some of the incidents which have happened in various parts of the city when colored people have moved into certain areas. Well, because we have what I think is going to be a unique type of organization in American community life. Not only do we deplore that kind of thing, but we're trying to do something about it. We feel that most of the trouble in this world, when you come right down to it, most of the trouble exists because people just don't sit down and talk to each other.
You can say that again, mister.
That we don't try hard enough in this world to understand the other fellow's problem, the other guy's point of view.
Now that's right.
Yes, that's the way we feel out in Claiborne Park. And that's why I was elected to come here this afternoon and talk to you people. Friendly-like, you know, the way people should talk to each other and see if we couldn't find some way to work this thing out. As I say, the whole business is a matter of caring about the other fellow. Anybody can see that you are a nice family of folks, hard-working and honest, I'm sure. Today, everybody knows what it means to be on the outside of something. And, of course, there's always somebody who is out to take the advantage of people who don't always understand.
What do you mean?
Well... You see, You see, our community is made up of people who've worked hard as the Dickens for years to build up that little community. They're not rich and fancy people, just hard-working, honest people who don't really have much but those little homes and a dream of the kind of community they want to raise their children in. Now, I don't say we're perfect, and there's a lot wrong in some of the things they want. But you've got to admit that a man, right or wrong, has the right to want to have the neighborhood he lives in a certain kind of way. And at the moment, the overwhelming majority of our people out there feel that most people get along better, take more of a common interest in the life of the community when they share a common background. I want you to believe me when I tell you that race prejudice simply doesn't enter into it. It's a matter of the people of Clybourne Park believing, rightly or wrongly, as I say, that for the happiness of all concerned, that our Negro families are happier when they live in their own communities. This, friends, is the Welcoming Committee.
Is this what you came marching all the way over here to tell us?
Well, now, we've been having a fine conversation. I hope you'll hear me all the way through.
Go ahead, man.
You see, in the face of all the things I've said, we're prepared to make your family a very generous offer.
30 pieces and not a coin less.
Yeah?
Our association is prepared, through the collective effort of our people, to buy the house from you at a financial gain to your family.
Lord have mercy, ain't that the live at all?
All right, you through?
And they throw him out. I trust, and this isn't always true with some of my students, that everybody knows 30 pieces and not a coin less alludes to
Judas.
Yeah, and the great, the traitor, and they're buying him off too.
Can't even make a profit just going on buying houses in
the night. Then, yeah. Rewrite this play. Walter, you can make money.
Yeah.
Well, they throw him out with great pride and anger both, and Walter demonstrates some real stalwart and strong attributes. But in the meantime, Walter gets the rest of the money and takes it and brings it to... Well, he invests it badly. We need a Bobo. That's a guy. Doesn't matter to him. Bobo's the guy that takes his money, and they're going to meet with Willie and head down to Springfield. They got to go down to Springfield. They think first, Springfield, Illinois, to bribe all the government officials so they don't have to, so they can get past all the licensing and all that kind of stuff. So we need a Bobo. We need we got to go quickly. We're on time. Okay, we need a Panifa again.
I'll do that.
Okay. And we need Mama. Okay. We need Ruth, okay, and we need Walter again, okay, and I think that covers us. And it starts right there where the line is drawn, and Walter starts it.
Where's Willie, man?
He ain't with me.
Oh, come on in. You know my wife.
Yes, Miss Ruth.
Hello, Bobo.
You right on time today, right on time. That's the way. Sit down. Let me hear.
Could I please get a drink of water before I tell you about Walter Lee?
There ain't nothing wrong, is there?
Let me tell you.
Man, didn't nothing go wrong.
Let me tell you, Walter Lee. You know how it was. I got to tell you how it was. I mean, first I got to tell you how it was all the way. I mean, about the money I put in, Walter Lee.
What about the money you put in?
Well, it wasn't much, as we told you, me and Willie. I'm sorry, Walter. I had a bad feeling about it. I got a real bad feeling about it.
Man, what you telling me about all this for? Tell me what happened in Springfield.
Springfield.
What was supposed to happen in Springfield?
This deal that me and Walter went into with Willie. Me and Willie was going to go down to Springfield and spread some money around so we wouldn't have to wait so long for the liquor license. That's what we were going to do. Everybody said there was a way you had to do it. You understand, Miss Ruth?
Man, what happened down there?
I'm trying to tell you, Walter.
Then tell me, goddammit, what's the matter with you?
I didn't go to no Springfield yesterday.
Why not?
Because I didn't have no reasons to.
Man, what are you talking about?
I'm talking about the fact that when I got to the train station yesterday morning, about 8 o'clock, like we planned, ma'am, Willie didn't never show up.
Why? Where was he? Where is he?
That's what I'm trying to tell you. I waited 6 hours, called his house, and I waited... 6 hours. I waited in that train station 6 hours. That was all the extra money I had in the world. Man, Willie is gone.
Gone? What you mean, Willie is gone? Gone where? You mean he went by himself? You mean he went off to Springfield by himself to take care of getting the license? You mean maybe he didn't want too many people in on the business down there? You know, Willie got his own ways. Maybe he was late yesterday. He just went down there without you. Maybe he's been calling you at home trying to tell you what happened or something. Maybe he just got sick. He's somewhere. He's got to be somewhere. We just got to find him. Me and you got to find him. We got to.
What's the matter with you, Walter? When the cat take off with your money, he don't leave no maps.
Willie, don't do it. Please don't do it. Man, not with that money. Man, please, not with that money. Oh, God, don't let it be true. Man, I trusted you. Man, I put my life in your hands. Man, that money is made out of my father's flesh.
I'm sorry, Walter. I had my life staked in the steel, too.
Son, is it gone? Son, I gave you $6,500. Is it gone? All of it? Benita's money, too?
Mama, I never went to the bank at all.
You mean your sister's school money? You used that, too? Walter?
Yes. All of it. It's all gone.
Mama!
I've seen him night after night come in and look at that rug and then look at me. The red showing in his eyes, the veins moving in his head. I seen him grow thin and old before he was 40, working and working and working like somebody's old horse, killing himself. And you give it all away in a day.
Mama.
Oh, God. Look down here and show me the strength.
Mama.
Strength.
Mama.
Strength.
Wow, great.
Forward.
Yeah, you're powerful. I get tears in my eyes. Okay. I'll get it later. We'll go fast. The last thing is, Linder comes back, and Benita has had a... She's just ripped into Walter and said, "You are no man, you're a wimp." And Walter then calls Linder and says, "Come on back, and we're going to deal with you." And we need Benita again. This thing has many more parts. We have Ruth. Okay. We have Mama. Okay. And we have Linder. Okay. And we have Walter. Okay. And this is Linder's second visit. And notice at the very beginning, at the top, they find out that Walter has called Linder, and Ruth says at the very top, "Travis, you go downstairs." And just note that what Mama... we have a Mama, don't we?
Yeah. Travis?
Travis is Walter and... well, here. Walter and Ruth's son. So Mama's grandson.
Okay.
And they all live together there. Travis is the future of this family, of course, and... There's a great scene in the beginning of the play where Travis asks his mother for 50 cents. She says, "I ain't got no 50 cents to be giving you. Now get to school." And Walter comes out and says, "What'd you tell the boy that for? Come here, son. Here's 50 cents, and here's 50 cents more." And he has no more money. But he's got to be what society says he has to be, which is the provider, the man of the house. And that's part of the issue here in the whole story, is that Mama runs the show, and Walter is kind of emasculated throughout until this scene here. So, go ahead, Mama. You can start. Ruth is just... Do we have a Ruth? We don't.
Yep.
No? Okay, go ahead, Ruth.
Travis, you go downstairs.
No. Travis, you stay right here. And you make him understand what you're doing, Walter Lee. You teach him good, like Willie Harris taught you. You show where our five generations done come to. Go ahead, son.
Now, what they're going to do is, if the plan is... "We're going to sell this house to you. I want my money, and we'll make a profit here."
"Well, Mr. Linder, we called you. Well, we are very plain people."
"Yes."
"I mean, I have worked as a chauffeur most of my life. And my wife here, she does domestic work in people's kitchens. So does my mother. I mean, we are plain people."
"Yes, Mr. Younger."
"And, well, my father... Well, he was a laborer most of his life.
Yes?
My father almost beat a man to death once because this man called him a bad name or something. You know what I mean?
No, I'm afraid I don't.
Well, what I mean is that we come from people who had a lot of pride. I mean, we are very proud people. And that's my sister over there, and she's going to be a doctor, and we are very proud.
Well, I'm sure that is very nice, but...
What I'm telling you is that we called you over here to tell you that we are very proud, and that this is my son, who makes the sixth generation of our family in this country, and that we have all thought about your offer, and we have decided to move into our house because my father, he earned it. We don't want to make no trouble for nobody or fight no causes, but we will try to be good neighbors. That's all we got to say. We don't want your money.
I take it then you have decided to occupy.
That's what the man said.
Then I would like to appeal to you, Mrs. Younger. You are older and wiser and understand things better, I'm sure.
I'm afraid you don't understand. My son said we was going to move, and there ain't nothing left for me to say. You know how these young folks is nowadays, mister. Can't do a thing with them. Goodbye.
Well, if you are that final about it, there's nothing left for me to say. I sure hope you people know what you're doing.
But for God's sake, if the movement men are here, let's get the hell out of here.
And that's almost the end of the next page. Any observations or thoughts? Or
great job, you guys. A good read. I mean, first read, it's like... My son is an actor, and he said it's the hardest thing of all. They walk in, they give him a script, and he's never seen it before, and you have to really be good, and you guys are. Any, we got a couple minutes to...
I don't know if it's the smartest choice that they're making to move into that neighborhood. I mean, they could probably use the money to do something else, but, like, his masculine pride is telling him that, like, he has to show his son that, like, he can be a provider and put him into the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And I think it was threatening to have his mother making decisions based more on, like, maybe emotions or, like, gut feelings, and, like, what society is all this.
Yeah, that's good. And if we had the whole play, for instance, you would know that Benita and Walter are always at each other's throats, and he's ashamed. He thinks it's stupid that she wants to be a doctor, and for him to say, that's my sister, and we are very proud of her. Mm-hmm. And that never happens before in the play. And he's making decisions, they all are, the whole family, not on the basis of money, or not on the basis of any kind of, as you said, external kind of social, that make money and live where you should, out of pride of their heritage. Yeah, it's good.
I think it too gets back to the idea of responsibility. I mean, he lost everything else they had, so he has to be responsible. It seems to me he's acting, trying to say, I got responsible for what I did. And the one way that I can give something back to my family is to make sure we make that move.
Yeah.
And no matter what it costs us, either by our neighbors hating us or breaking our windows or burning crosses in our yard, whatever it is, I'm going to make that move because we've got to do something. Yeah. I've got to do something.
But that's like also breaking out of like their cultural background and their tradition. Like, I don't know if that, so I don't really know if that's like what's... I mean, it seems like Benita's already pushing those lines by talking to Mama about, like, not believing in God, which is, like, you know, a central thing, like, in that American culture, is, like, that deep religious belief, especially, like, 100 years ago. But I don't know. I don't know about Walter.
It does seem like there's something countercultural at work, but I think what strikes me most about that is that it's crossing the gender line. Here, he had gone on his own thinking he had the best plan and blew it. Mama had bought that house, which I thought was kind of ridiculous in the beginning, but now he's affirming his sister and affirming his mother, choosing we are proud, not just I am proud, and choosing to be part of the family and choosing to go the distance together rather than what would have been the easier way to take the money for the house and try to do something.
But do you think he's also doing that just to like reaffirm his masculinity in front of his son? Or do you think he's doing that to, like, you know, back up his mother and his sister?
Look at the language of the play, what he says. That's a great question. Yeah. But is there an answer in the play to your question? Look at what he says.
We are playing people.
Six generations.
Mm-hmm. And how he says it, I mean, I don't know where tears fit into the scenario.
It's interesting too how the conflict went from, like what you're saying, like the cultural conflict in general, moving into a neighborhood of all white people, to suddenly the conflict within just the family. Like, it so dramatically ties those two conflicts together. Mm-hmm. You know?
Conflict within the family and between the blacks and the whites. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And part of the conflict of the family is where you're coming from. Is that he's got a role he wants to play, mm-hmm. for sure. But he also has tears, and he also claims six generations of we are proud people, and my papa worked, and we earned that house. He earned that house. So it's you're right, but it's more than that too. It's good. It's good reading.
It also seems to me that that's the only part of his father that he has left. When he says, "We decided to move into that house because my father, he earned it." He's lost everything else his father has given him, except for that house. Mm-hmm. So he's got to go there. That's all part of his father's gone.
And I think in the scenes that we read today didn't really cover everything, but they're also just feeling this great need to find a new place, to get out of where they are. And there's like Mama's sister lives there or something, right? And they want to... Remember that
Mr. Johnson lives down the hall. We have wait in line for a bathroom.
Yeah, things like that. But so it just seemed like that there's just this desire to find a new place, and I think that's why Mom goes and buys this house in the first place.
Well, and that's a great point. And then you don't know this part, but Ruth is pregnant. Her husband doesn't know it yet, and she has gone out to talk to a doctor. And he calls, and when she comes back, Mama says, "Where have you been?" I went to see, there was a woman, and that tips her off in 1951 that the woman is the one to do an abortion. And we make our kids live, not die, says Mom. And Walter doesn't know any of this, and so that's part of the dynamic here too of what motivates Mom, and we got to get out of here. I mean, we're talking about killing our babies because of the tension of this place and this oppression. Well, great job, gang. Thank you. Okay.